You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places and sounds of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're with a mariachi band, but not in a mariachi hotspot like the eponymous plaza in Boyle Heights. We're in a park in Santa Monica. The mariachis to be practicing here are kind of new to the craft.
I learned how to play violin, and I like it because all the teachers are nice, and it's fun, and you like can learn an instrument just by doing it.
That's 9-year-old Hannah Rappaport Common, now in her second year in the Santa Monica Youth Orchestra's Mariachi Ensemble. She's one of about 70 kids in the nonprofit's group, which takes them as young as 6 and maxes out at 16. They're all from around Santa Monica's Pico neighborhood, where they practice in Virginia Avenue Park. And it's all free, even an instrument if you can't afford one. KCRW's Angel Carrera has caught up with the band right before a big gig, and he brings us their story.
Willie Acuña teaches this ensemble. He's about as successful as an American-born mariachi can be. He's part of a Grammy-nominated mariachi group. He shared the stage with Ginny Rivera, and he's even played for George Harrison. Yeah, the Beatles guy. He's got the whole stage fright thing under control, but it's this performance at a local park that's been keeping him up at night.
Well, I work in a group that travels a bit. Like, for example, in 2 weeks, we're going to play the Latin Grammys in... We've done the Hollywood Bowl. We've done arenas all over the country, but these performances are where I get really nervous because these are my kids, you know, like these are my kids. And I'm like, oh man, like I want to make sure they do well and they represent themselves well and their parents are proud.
One of his kids is Yahira Santiago, an 11-year-old that's in the 6th grade. He's been with this group for just 3 weeks. He and his buddies are calmly tuning their instruments. He's nowhere near as anxious as his teacher.
I felt like obviously a little like nervous, but at the most part, when you get that good mix of the sounds, you feel confident.
He and the rest of the ensemble are already performing full songs, no sheet music, all from memory. Most of these kids have had little to no experience with instruments.
So it feels wonderful to know that this is something that they're doing. They're taking time away from their one day to today off to come to do this.
That's Shabnam Fasah. She studied ethnomusicology at UCLA and founded the nonprofit Santa Monica Youth Orchestra 7 years ago. The goal? To teach under-resourced kids music from around the world and LA's many cultures in the process.
We started the program to build an environment where kids were coming from all different socioeconomic backgrounds, schools, different levels of playing, and coming together to build community at a park in Santa Monica where the kind of the zip code is the most diverse. It just happens to be that it's such an eclectic group of kids that we have there. So it's a kind of a snapshot of that community, and those kids are going to grow up and they're going to know their neighbors because they got to take this musical journey with them. They have to start from measure one, and the goal is to get to measure 100 and something together as a team, not against another group. So it's about solving a problem together. It's much more about building community than learning how to play the note correctly.
Kids learn the classics like Bach and Beethoven, but also Japanese koto, Ghanaian drumming, and now, mariachi. The mariachi ensemble was added after the urging of parents. Fasah lined up several teachers, including Acuña, who was a little reluctant at first.
So it's about finding music that's at their level, and a lot of the kids don't speak Spanish. So we go through every song, through all the words, what everything means, so they know exactly what they're singing, and we go through diction, right, because we all have that, we're all pochitos, you know. All of us who were born in the U.S., we're all pochitos, and we pronounce things miscorrectly. And, miscorrectly? Is that even word? Incorrectly? We mispronounce things, right? We say things incorrectly. And, let's see this. I told the parents this, that watch your kids. They're going to start asking more questions about this and be more interested in their own culture, right? The ones who are of the culture. And the ones who aren't of the culture, it's a beautiful thing because I think it's great for parents to be exposing their kids to this.
For some kids, it's more than a cultural education.
We would have kids that just, they brighten your day. And then sometimes you'd hear things, maybe, you hear about some of their home situations, and this is one of their outlets. And I think, wow, this is, it's more than just music education. It's a way for them to express themselves away from school, away from home. Something that maybe their main group of friends might not be into, but they get to do for themselves. It's part of they're beginning to identify themselves as mariachis, and that's beautiful. That's awesome, you know.
Back at the park, students are hanging out on a small field just before a screening of Disney's Coco. They're not fazed by their families and friends watching, or the passersby who stop and stare, looking at what's going on. They're relaxed. They've got this. In its short time, the program has already had success stories. One of their former students got into the LA Phil's Mariachi program. They're going to play at Mexico's Palacio de Bellas Artes next month with Gustavo Dudamel. The program's teamed up with the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District. That means even more students are exposed to mariachi music. For KCRW, I'm Angel Carreras.
Well, coming up, talented athletes may get more than just a free education at California colleges or universities. So what will the NCAA do about it? What can it do about it? You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're a student in college who's really good at a sport. You get a scholarship. You play your heart out, and the school wins on the field or on the hardwood. The school also wins big in the marketplace, where your efforts, along with the other athletes, make a ton of money for said school. You, of course, win with a free education and possibly a career in the pros, too. It's a big win. But a new California law will help you with some money as well. Lawmakers and the governor recently passed a bill that, starting in 2023, will allow those athletes to be compensated for their name, image, or likeness. Well, now the National Collegiate Athletics Association, or NCAA, says it hopes to avoid a court battle against other states that may follow in California's lead. Matt Money Smith co-hosts the Petros and Money Show on AM 570 LA Sports. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. You're in the car, I venture a guess here. Yeah, where are you, by the way?
I am navigating the 605 North and route to the 10 East.
Oh, right, I see. All right. So you're headed, this is like Whittier way, right? Norwalk, perhaps?
I'm passing through Norwalk right now. And yes, while we're having this conversation, likely Whittier too.
How's the traffic, by the way? Is it okay?
Not bad. I got me one of them fancy plug-in hybrids.
Okay.
So I get to roll carpool.
Oh, that's nice.
And it helps the world. That's why I have it, not the carpool lane.
Shut up, Steve, about traffic, all right? This is, by the way, Fair Pay to Play Act. Is the state forcing schools to pay student athletes?
No. The state is forcing the NCAA to change the model of amateur athletics as it relates to college sports. The Fair Pay to Play Act says, and I think the best way I can illustrate this without it getting too complicated, and it's not that complicated, but Rams running back Todd Gurley got in trouble while he was at Georgia because it was discovered that he accepted, or it was alleged that he accepted, $3,500 from a memorabilia dealer for signing autographs on a bunch of Georgia. He went to Georgia, a bunch of mini helmets and mini footballs,
mm-hmm.
And that is not allowed. So he got in trouble. The school got in trouble. And basically what this bill says is Todd Gurley shouldn't get in trouble for that. You know, he's playing. He's put in harm's way. He is helping the University of Georgia sell tickets to come watch Georgia football. We're not saying the university has to pay him, but if this memorabilia dealer wants to, he should be able to get paid. And as the rules are currently situated and stipulated, he can't. That's a violation. So that's for the most part the centerpiece of the idea behind this bill.
So
starting
in 2023, someone like that athlete will be able to do just what, you know, the signing of the helmets.
Right. You know, or and this is where, if you want to hear some people push back on it, the pushback is, well, this is just going to lead to unsavory characters, you know, under the guise of hiring someone as a spokesperson or employee, writing a $150,000 check so they come play football at their alma mater. To which I say, so what? You know, it happens. That's already happening. You know, it's just happening under the table. I mean, that's if that's, you know, if you want Nathan Arizona from Unpainted Arizona to hire the best quarterback in the nation to come sell furniture so he goes to U of A, then whatever.
That's a blast from the past.
Yes. I'm glad you picked up on that.
Where did he play? Didn't he play at ASU? Arizona State, didn't he? Yeah. Fork him.
Exactly.
Right. Oh, my God, Matt. So what are some of the ways? All right, if it's not signing headphones, signing helmets, what other ways can student-athletes make money like that would right now get them in trouble, but in California starting in 2023 would not get them in trouble?
Well, to be honest, there's really none, because that's their great fear. Like, you know, my broadcast partner Petros, you know, he had issues working at his father's restaurant as a busboy because, you know, John Papadakis was a former USC linebacker. They hosted recruiting dinners there, and the idea was, when he's a student at USC, even though it's his family restaurant, could that restaurateur pay him $1,000 a night to bus tables in order to curry favor for USC to gain his football playing services? So right now, athletes can't take any money anywhere if they're on scholarship. And it really is somewhat ridiculous. And that's the idea behind it, is they don't want these schools bidding, or at least their boosters bidding for players, is, you know, providing, you know, an unfair competitive advantage for schools that have a bunch of these, you know, an alumni group that's willing to do this. And that's why everybody goes to fill in the blank. I mean, I'll pick a school in the SEC because, oh, I don't know, I've just decided to do that. Say the University of Mississippi.
Yeah.
So that's their thinking, but it's archaic. It's outdated, you know? So now the NCAA, with, you know, just 2 weeks ago, met and said, yes, we believe this is the right way to press forward, and we want it installed by 2021. So that's, it's going to happen. This is going to come together, and students are going to be able to make money while they're in school because they're really good football or basketball players.
Well, other states, Matt, are also looking at their own bill. So it's not only California. Other states want to follow in California's lead. Do you think this is going to turn into sort of a and this is what critics say, that a kind of a free-for-all where states are competing for these athletes? You mentioned, you know, hey, does someone want to go to the University of Mississippi? I mean, there's this free-for-all in offering them the most lenient rules.
And I think that's where the NCAA is trying to come in and say, hey, this has to be uniform, so work with us. And the NCAA, look, they're a pain by all descriptions. They are not easy to deal with. They have... And look, I'm not going to sit here. I do not believe that. I do believe there is, to some degree, the exploitation just because of the large sums of money that are being brought in. And the idea that these guys can't figure, and these, you know, women can't figure out a way to stipend these players at a higher rate where they can have a wage that maybe they do get to send some money home, because so many of them come, you know, from underprivileged situations and could help them out while they're making these, you know, billions of dollars for these universities. But at the same time, the universities do so much for them. You know, it's not like Todd Gurley at Georgia is going to be signing helmets for that $3,600 if he went to Georgia State instead. You know, there is no $3,600 for Todd Gurley if he's playing at Georgia Southern instead of the University of Georgia, because people want that University of Georgia helmet, and Todd Gurley just happens to play there. So one hand does, in fact, wash the other. I do find it insulting when I hear people on ESPN like Jalen Rose, you know, say that the NCAA is this, you know, nothing short of evil entity that does nothing but exploit talent, when if Jalen Rose is not a member of the Fab Five at Michigan, he's not on your TV. I mean, that's why he wasn't, by no means was he an exceptional. He was a very, very good college athlete, and he was a very, very good NBA player, but not one that would garner the attention that he now garners because he was part of the Fab Five. You know, and the same thing goes when you're a standout quarterback at Alabama. It's different than being a celebrated quarterback at Tulsa. So the university does things for these individuals that other universities can't. And beyond a free education, as someone who has a daughter in college right now and knows what that is worth, and it's a giant sum, then I would love for that to be, you know, I would love to have, and again, I'm in a different financial situation than many of these kids. My daughter, and I'm doing the air quotes, exploited for their advantage. I think some athletes that constantly push back on the NCAA saying this is so unfair and they make all the money and none of us do, they have to recognize there is a huge benefit for them playing at these historically relevant athletic institutions.
I mean, why is it that we reach out to you, Matt Money, and your partner in crime, Petros? We know that by being with you on the radio that our gravitas like increases tenfold, right? So, which is the example that you're trying to make. You're right. The Georgia versus Georgia Southern, Georgia versus Georgia State, or Alabama Crimson Tide versus Tulsa. The NCAA has threatened that California schools might get shut out of national competitions if they break the rules on athletes being paid. Does that seem like a real threat? Is that something they could come down, you know, hard with?
I think that was unwise. I think that was something they did in the moment as a knee-jerk reaction, and I immediately recognized how, A, ridiculous it sounded, and, B, how quickly they could become irrelevant. Remember, the BC, so maybe you won't remember. I don't know how many listeners would. There was an organization called the Bowl Championship Series that ran, for the most part, for all intents and purposes, the national championship for college football. That was not an NCAA product. It was something that was put together by an outside group and functioned with a television contract and an agreement with the NCAA that their schools would participate in this particular set of games, of football games, to crown a national champion without a playoff. So I think the NCAA quickly, A, got a ton of pushback, and in the form of, hey, something's going to have to give, because all of these coaches that are making $10 million a year and all of these TV deals that are public that are worth billions of dollars over their life cannot continue to be publicized when you're hearing stories about kids in California schools that are on an $1,100 a month or $900 a month stipend can't, you know, for the most part, you know, if you live in a place like LA or you go to Cal in San Francisco, it's just not enough.
Yeah, you know, we're gonna have to end it there, Matt Money. It's about the money, Matt Money Smith, as you know.
Exactly right.
Matt Money Smith. Safe travels to you, my friend. You can hear him, by the way, on the Petros and Money Show on KLAC AM 570 Sports. Matt, thanks for your time.
Oh, you're the best. Thanks for having me.
Well, just ahead, a school board budget fight that may have more to do with politics than money. Off to OC we go on Greater LA. You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Off to Orange County now, where the Board of Education is trying to cut the school district's budget. The superintendent isn't on board, and that means there's a standoff, one that has lasted way beyond the time when the budget is supposed to be finalized. Well, for weeks, the California Department of Education has been threatening to step in and take over the county school board's budget, but nothing has happened as yet. It is Monday. It's time for Orange County Line with Gustavo Arellano. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Certainly the first question is, what's going on with this district budget? Is it short on funds? Are these cuts essential to fiscal prudence?
The Board of Education in Orange County, five-person board, they, 4 months ago, they told the superintendent, Al Mijares, hey, you know, we like your budget, $257 million. We don't have a problem except for about $170,000. We're going to strike that from that budget because we think it's useless. And that $170,000 is set aside for lobbying in Sacramento, for conferences that teachers can go and educators can go, which all educators go to all the time. And that's that. $170,000 is less than 1% of the budget. Mijares said, no, I need this. The Board of Education tried to forward that budget onto Sacramento without his signature, which apparently you can't do. So now there's this impasse, which now involves the Board of Education hiring legal help in a lawsuit that might target Mijares.
So we're talking $170,000, yeah. And they're hiring legal representation on both sides or through the board. So that's going to cost money, right?
Exactly. No one's talking, obviously. The Orange County Register, they broke this story and they try to get comment from the Board of Education. And they said, well, we can't comment because there's pending litigation and we cannot even confirm nor deny what this pending litigation is going to target, except it involves the budget. So that's going to cost money as well. So this is, I mean, it's a really, really bizarre story. The state is saying, hey, this has been 4 months since you were supposed to turn over this budget. If you do not get your act together, we're going to take over the district. We're going to take over your $257 million budget, and we're going to administer it. So this is something, and it's interesting because the Orange County Department of Education, you rarely hear about because, you know, there's so many school districts. What they're in charge of is, secondary education for students who don't go to traditional schools. They also train teachers in the different school districts in Orange County. So it's one of these entities that people forget about, but they're very important to Orange County public education.
This has been going on for months. You say the state has said it would get involved. That was about a month ago. It still hasn't. Do you think it will?
I think something's going to happen with the state because you can't have a board that's preparing to sue someone, which is probably going to be the superintendent. Meanwhile, there is no budget for the school district. Again, the budget is for $257 million, and they're fighting over 0.1% of the budget. If you're the bosses of the Orange County Department of Education, which in this case is the state, yeah, you're going to come in and say, hey, like, enough's enough. Get your football, go to another sandbox, or let's get together and let's play and let's make something out of it.
Is this a riff? I mean, Al Mijares has been there for a while. Is this a riff, Gustavo, that you think will continue? Are these board members and the superintendent, for that matter, are these elected positions? Is there factionalizing going on? What's happening here? What are the politics of this situation? Because this sounds, I mean, to me, when I saw it for the first time, it was like they want to cut just this one little tiny sliver out. It sounded a bit punitive, but then they're saying this is about fiscal responsibility.
Yeah, no, this is petty politics at its worst. So, again, 0.1% of the budget has been holding up a $257 million budget. So this actually goes back a couple of years because Al Mijares, he's been elected. Let's see, he was elected in 2018 and also in 2014. So he's been there for a couple of years. And he's facing off against Ken Williams, who's one of the board members. He's been there for about 25 years. And Ken Williams is an advocate for charter schools. And so in an op-ed for the Register, he said, yeah, it might seem like a little bit, but under Mijares, Department County of Education is wasting money by trying to lobby against charter schools, which is what Ken Williams is in favor for. Al Mijares, a couple weeks later in the pages of the Orange County Register, rebuts him saying, like, actually, no, the person who's really incompetent is Ken Williams and his faction. Well, in the last election, Ken Williams was able to get a majority that has been mostly siding with him. And Ken Williams has been very controversial in the past for his conservative views. Last year, the big issue was he or other people within the district, they were fighting against California trying to revamp its sex education to be a little bit more positive towards LGBTQ students. And so it's been culture wars now being fought over, again, 0.1% of a budget.
Well, not only culture wars, but also it seems a political campaign that's being set up and played out right now with the budget process.
Exactly. And what's interesting, they told the Register this has never happened before. The Orange County Department of Education has always sent their budget not just on time, but even before that. So to have even a couple of days delay is a little bit weird. To have a couple of weeks is strange. To have 4 months worth, something's wrong at the Department of Education. And that's why the state is ready to swoop in.
Well, we'll keep an eye on this story. Gustavo Arellano, writer for the LA Times, and here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias. We'll be right back.
That's it for today. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast, would you? I'm Steve Chiatakis on this Monday. Thanks for the ear. Have yourself a great day.